On this episode of Skeptico.
In many ways, philosophers are pointing out that there's a conceptual error there, and that has to do with confusing technology with science. Technology has been so successful in over the last 200-300 years that we become hypnotized by it in a way. And we imagine that the world around us is like a great big clockwork of some sort, and that everything follows a kind of rationalistic, materialistic logic. But I think that occurs because we project the success that we've had with technology onto all of nature. And nature herself does not necessarily obey mechanistic principles all of the time.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science and spirituality with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode, Dr. Jeffrey Mishlove joins me. He was actually a guest like 10 years ago, which we talk a little bit about on the show, which is pretty amazing. And if you don't know anything about him, he's really, really an interesting guy. He has kind of seen it all, done it all when it comes to parapsychology, and has been involved with parapsychology education and public communication about it for a long, long time. And his show, Thinking Aloud, which was originally on PBS, and his new show, New Thinking Aloud, are just mainstays for this kind of information. But the other thing I want to talk to him about is this book that he wrote a long time ago called PK Man. And it's about his encounters with this guy, Ted Owens. And we talk a little bit about it in the interview, so I don't have to repeat it. But it is an absolutely amazing kind of paradigm-shattering account of psychokinesis and psychic powers in a human being. And I don't know how history has managed to kind of sidestep this case, because it's really well documented in so many ways. So that's an interesting angle to mix into this old thing. I mean, here's this guy who's been in the parapsychology field for 30, 40 years, and he's got this amazing firsthand experience with this guy who could direct thunderbolts with his finger and summon UFOs and make the weather change. Incredible. So there's a lot there to kind of ponder and think about. Here's my interview with Dr. Jeffrey Mishlove. Today we welcome Dr. Jeffrey Mishlove to Skeptico. Jeff is the creator and host of New Thinking Aloud, a very impressive YouTube interview show that tackles cutting-edge, conscious-related topics, as well as some very deep spirituality, which really makes it especially terrific. And he does it in a very intelligent way, a very academic way, but at the same time, accessible, at least to most of us. So Dr. Mishlove is also the author of several books, including The Roots of Consciousness and The PK Man, which, even though it was published 17 years ago in 2000, it remains, in my opinion, one of the most important books about psi that really has ever been written. And that's not hype. I hope we have a good deal of time to talk about PK Man. It's so important and it's so mind-blowing in so many ways. Anyways, it's been, as I was just chatting 1 second ago to Jeff, it's been 10 years since Dr. Mishlove was on Skeptico. I can't believe it's that long, but it is certainly great to have him back. Jeff, welcome and thanks so much for joining me.
It's a pleasure to be with you again, Alex.
So, you know, and this is something else I just mentioned to you a minute ago. I was digging into doing some research for this interview, and I kept coming across all this stuff that you've done, and I don't want to like make you sound old or anything, but you've been doing so much of this great stuff for a long time, and a lot of people will know and remember the original Thinking Aloud program that was caused quite a stir at the time. It was really, really cutting edge out there for a lot of people. It was on PBS. A lot of people saw it, and people, you can still go and see a lot of those clips on YouTube and in other places on the net. But then, you know, you were doing this kind of stuff. You had this itch for broadcasting and this desire to communicate all the way back to your days at Berkeley, didn't you? I mean, that's what I stumbled across.
Well, I think I was guided in a way. I started doing radio at KPFA FM in Berkeley back in 1972. And I was going through a crisis in my life at the time because I was a graduate student in criminology and I wanted to really switch over somehow to study higher consciousness and psychic functioning. And I didn't know how to do it. And after many, many months of agonizing about it, I was guided by a dream and it led me to volunteer at KPFA radio. And within 3 weeks, I had produced a radio show and they gave me a program called The Mind's Ear that was broadcast twice a week. And I found myself, like you, sitting across a table with world-class experts. And that's what gave me the confidence to set up an individual interdisciplinary doctoral major in parapsychology at Berkeley, where I was already a graduate student.
And that's quite an amazing story in itself. I mean, you're the only person, as has been reported over and over again, there's kind of different ways to cut that, you know, everyone wants to slice that. You're the only person who got a PhD in parapsychology. Wow, great. And you're the only person who got a PhD in psychology, parapsychology. Oh my God, you know, what the heck's going on? But
The distinction is simply that my diploma actually says parapsychology.
Right.
There are certainly other people who got doctoral degrees in psychology or philosophy.
Of course.
Education who have done parapsychology dissertations.
Of course. But what we're pointing out is that, you know, certainly at that point, you couldn't have imagined that this much time would go by and there would still be, you know, the only person hanging up that thing on the wall that says parapsychology on it. It's just, it speaks a lot to the field that we'll talk about later. But I mean, it's kind of sad, really.
Yeah, it is sad.
So, but let's switch gears for a minute because, so great, you start out with Berkeley, but this does pop up again and again. You are a communicator about this stuff, and that seems to be always in your, you know, you've drifted away from it a little bit and you were kind of forced because the way the academic system looks on these topics, you know, it didn't exactly provide a real easy path for you to go down and get a professorship or, you know, have that kind of life. That just wasn't an opportunity for you. But you kept coming back to this communication stuff. Tell, you know, I guess you hinted at that. I mean, it's always been in you. I mean, has it always been your vision?
Well, I can tell you this. Back in 1986, I took a training program offered by Ted Owens, the man about whom the book, The PK Man, was written. And he was a master of psychokinesis. And he asked me, what do you want to do with this ability? He was a guy who could conjure up hurricanes and make UFOs manifest and wild shamanistic things of that sort. And I thought about it and I said, what I really want to do is to become a communicator between the esoteric world of psychic phenomena and the mainstream population. And it was within a few months of taking that training that I launched the original Thinking Aloud television series. And I've been at it. There was a 10-year gap in there somewhere, but I've been at it mostly ever since then.
You know, I read that anecdote. That is so cool. I mean, because we're going to talk more about Ted Owens later, but it's cool to think about what could have been the otherworldly influence that drove that, but then we can just kind of leave that aside and say, you know, someone goes and says, Jeff, in your heart of hearts, you know, what do you really want to help in doing and bring forth in your life? And that's your thing. You know, that's kind of cool, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it's been a great life as far as I'm concerned. There have been all kinds of obstacles thrown in my path, but I wouldn't change it at all.
Okay. So, hey, before we get too far off track, let's talk a little bit about the new show. Mm-hmm. New Thinking Aloud. People have found it on YouTube. It looks great, has super great production quality, which you do a really nice job of. It's not like a Skype thing. Nothing wrong with Skype. We're talking on Skype right now, but it's more of a studio looking thing and, you know, great audio and all that stuff. But to tell us the new in the New Thinking Aloud, because as you said, there's that 10-year gap. Now you have a new show. Is there a new focus? I don't know. It's great. It's great stuff. What's changed?
Well, in the original Thinking Aloud series, we covered philosophy, psychology, health, science, and spirituality. Now I'm focusing primarily on parapsychology specifically because, as you pointed out earlier, it's been nearly 40 years. I'm the only person in the world ever to receive an accredited doctoral diploma in parapsychology. And that's a painful thing for me. So my expectation is that eventually there are going to be many academic programs of this sort and that they're going to want to envision parapsychology the way that I do, which is to include, you know, millennia of spiritual traditions and explorations of the psychic realm in the ethno-historical records of every culture. And so my goal now with the New Thinking Aloud series is to create an archive of the best material that I can find with the most valuable people. And there are many great parapsychologists who are alive today. And so that in the future, when those educational programs eventually are established, they'll have this as a resource.
Eternal optimist. I got to say, eternal optimist when it comes to parapsychology. But the other thing I want to pick up on is this deep spirituality, because it seemed to me that you were in a very intelligent way, but broadening to this new emerging spirituality. But then I went back and looked at the original Thinking Aloud, and that was always in the DNA of that show as well. But has this spiritual interest in the way that you approach it deep and broadened for you in the years, or is it still you see the same vision of that?
Well, I guess I can say this. My philosophy is that the spiritual traditions of the world are now the birthright of every human being. That it's no longer required that you have to accept the religion into which you were born, because every religion, every cultural tradition has some very unique insights into the nature of consciousness. And we're all entitled to partake of all of that.
Yeah, but what I like is you don't just explore it from that angle, because that sounds like kind of this religious equality kind of thing. I mean, you dig deep and try and bring science to it as well. I mean, many of your guests have done that, right? I think the name's going to escape me now, but who's the most recent guy you had on who was talking about the after-death communicate? Betty?
Stafford Betty, who's a professor of religious studies at the California State University in Bakersfield.
Excellent. And your interview was excellent, and his information was excellent. And here's a guy, and I think this is, to me, the quintessential New Thinking Aloud. He says, look, I don't have any strong religious connection to this. I just have, and as a matter of fact, I see religion kind of in slightly less favorable light based on my research. I just wanted to look at issues that typically are included or exclusively the category of religion. That is, you know, how do people encounter God in the afterlife, or how do they encounter whatever that is, afterlife? And I approached it from this mediumistic kind of do, but very scientific and stuff like that. I mean, that to me seems to be really your sweet spot in New Thinking Aloud.
I would agree with you. We're in an era in which science is beginning to offer many important insights that were once considered exclusively the realm of religion.
If I can, though, I want to switch back to talk about parapsychology, because it interests me. I think the deep spirituality is the most important, and I think the consciousness and the
parapsychology stuff is a distant second. But it's interesting, when I asked you, you kind of put it the other way around, which is cool. I mean, that's where you're coming from, and I like that. But I went and listened to the interview we did 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I guess there's a little bit of kind of I told you so in here for me. But I can't see the glass quite as half full when it comes to parapsychology as you do. So I love the optimistic, internal optimist spin that you put on it, but I see the state of parapsychology and the progress of or lack of progress of parapsychology in the last 10 years in kind of a different view. So I was hoping we could kick that around. What do you think is the state of parapsychology right now?
I think you have to take a real long-term view of it. William James wrote well over 100 years ago, when the field was known as psychical research. But at that point, he said, we cannot judge this field decade by decade the way we would judge other fields. We have to look at it century by century instead, because we're dealing with something so very profound, our fundamental understanding of space and time and consciousness. So that's what makes me optimistic, is because I can look out maybe 200-400 years from now and see where things are going. If I had to say, well, you know, what's happened in the last decade or two, or if, in fact, the last, let's say, 5 decades since I've been active in the field, I was much more optimistic and excited back in the 70s than I am today. At that point, I thought parapsychology would revolutionize everything. And it's interesting, because my friend Jacques Vallée, the great UFO researcher, remembers those days. And he was involved in the creation of the internet. And he said, yes, I was involved in parapsychology and in the internet. And they both seem to have revolutionary promise. But only the internet has so far actualized that potential. Parapsychology has yet to do so, but the data is there. The research is actually very good. There are significant practical applications that have been developed. It's just that there's enormous social resistance, and that's going to take a long, long time to wear away.
Okay, and maybe we'll explore that in a minute, and what are the driving forces behind that resistance, both socially and within academia and science in general. But just to be clear, you know, I pulled out some quotes just to kind of establish where we're at. You look up parapsychology, first thing that comes up is Wikipedia. We all hate Wikipedia, but we have to acknowledge the place that it holds in our collective culture opinion forming thing. Yeah. Opening paragraph, last sentence. Parapsychology, it is identified as pseudoscience by the overwhelming majority of mainstream scientists. Well, of course, that's bullshit. But aside from that, that's there. But then what I did, and this to me is even worse, is you go to the Parapsychology Association website, and it says, most parapsychologists today expect that further research will eventually explain these anomalies. That is, everything we're talking about, ESP, psychokinesis, and survival of consciousness, in a scientific, what they're really saying is materialistic mind equals brain terms. So that's been the failing that I see. I mean, that's the disappointment that I think you feel or talked about, and I certainly feel, is that there's been this coup from within, where even the Parapsychology Association is, you know, been kind of taken over from the inside and has kind of lost its way, in my opinion, saying that, oh, we're all convinced that all this is going to be explained as materialistic science as we know it. That's just crazy. That's just ridiculous.
Well, there are, I would say, a minority of parapsychologists who consider themselves physicalists or materialists who hold that view. But most of the people in parapsychology, and I think Well, I'm sure I can speak for most of the people in parapsychology and say that when they say there will be a scientific explanation, they don't necessarily mean a mechanistic, materialistic explanation. I think they're talking about a new kind of science, a science that will be based on a different sort of metaphysics, whether that's idealism or panpsychism. It's hard to say right now, but there are some very exciting developments in the philosophy of mind as well that suggest to me that, you know, in coming generations, we're going to have very different views of what we mean when we use basic terms like time, space, matter, and energy.
I have no doubt, no argument there. I just think, again, look back to your show and the current version of your show and what you're doing.
Yeah.
Where you're mining in the deep spirituality kind of vein just seems so much more relevant, deep, rich than when we turn our focus to the very narrow-minded, why people believe weird things that parapsychology in a lot of cases has become, or the very kind of very limited, narrow, you know, how can we make this little psi experiment work? To me, we've reached the jumping off point where we have to jump in the way that you're doing and say, okay, what are the broader implications for this complete redo of our understanding of consciousness? And that is that it's somehow in some way fundamental. I mean, that's where everything seems to be pointing. And that's why it doesn't make any sense for the Parapsychology Association to even say something like that and say, no, we can keep going down this path. It will eventually work out. No, it's not. Until you make that shift, none of it makes any sense.
Well, there's nothing inherent in the scientific method that requires that it be wedded to materialistic philosophy.
Good point.
That's kind of, a historical fact right now, but in many ways, philosophers are pointing out that there's a conceptual error there, and that has to do with confusing technology with science. Technology has been so successful in over the last 200-300 years that we become hypnotized by it in a way. And we imagine that the world around us is like a great big clockwork of some sort, and that everything follows a kind of rationalistic, materialistic logic. But I think that occurs because we project the success that we've had with technology onto all of nature. And nature herself does not necessarily obey mechanistic principles all of the time.
I always say this, the shut up and calculate thing, you know, that they reached in quantum physics, which is like, oh my God, here, at least all these discoveries seem to be completely contradicting our understanding of consciousness. Consciousness is fundamental. And then somebody comes in and says, okay, but shut up and calculate. Let's figure out how we can take it, which we've done. I mean, quantum physics is at the heart of the computer is cellular information explosion that we've had, but it doesn't remove the fact that we just kind of bypassed the deeper philosophical questions that quantum physics was struggling with 100 years ago. So I think a lot of people, exactly what you're saying about technology, they don't realize that, you know, it's not an either or thing. I mean, you can ignore the philosophical questions and still go on with your life, but the philosophical questions and the philosophy of science questions are still there, even if you ignore them. What do you think about that?
Well, Alex, I think it's useful to appreciate that humanity itself is really just in its infancy. I mean, we think of ourselves as being so advanced because we have all of this technology, but really the earliest human civilizations are only maybe 10,000 years old. And in the larger scheme of things, that's virtually nothing. I mean, I can envision a day when humans will look back and they'll have a history that will extend for perhaps a million years like other species have. And so we have a lot of evolution ahead of us as a culture.
Interesting. Yeah, that's an interesting point. Let me ask one more question in that vein. I've, for whatever reason, kind of gone out of my way to talk to some of those people on the, I'm going to call it radical fringe because I think it's radical fringe on the other side, but like Caroline Watt, Richard Wiseman, the people that some people consider skeptics, but are really the mainstream science types. Have you talked to those people, and what do you think about engaging with those kind of people? Caroline Watt, just for people who don't know, was the head of the parapsychology unit at University of Edinburgh, which is probably the one of the most consistently funded and continuing programs in parapsychology, although they've completely undermined that and turned it into both investigating psi, but also investigating pseudo-psi, and they kind of mixed that in. But I interviewed her because she wrote this paper, "There's Nothing Paranormal About Near-Death Experiences, How Neuroscience Can Explain Seeing Bright Lights, Meeting the Dead, or Being Convinced You Are One of Them," which is just a disaster of a paper. We totally deconstructed it. It's, they're misquotes. The people she used are totally inappropriate. And then she wraps it up by saying, when I really pushed her, she goes, "Hey, it was just intended to be a provocative piece. I wasn't claiming it to be balanced." I mean, this to me is what we're getting from the other side. Do you engage in that dialogue, or do you choose to kind of take the high road and go the other way? Or what do you think about that?
Well, I do engage in it, but minimally so. There are a number of people in academia who are politically astute, and they realize that they're going to have more opportunities for career promotion and for grants and so on if they take that skeptical tactic. And I think it's a very short-term strategy. I think it does more damage than good in the long run. And I personally have never chosen to go that route. But I can name a handful of people for whom that's been a successful path to career advancement.
So let's get back and talk about New Thinking Aloud. I want to kind of approach it from another angle, because you do a fantastic job in the show, and one of the reasons is because you do have this deep and broad knowledge about so many things. I'm just amazed that you go from one guest to another, and you're in a completely different topic, and you're talking to biblical scholar Richard Smalley, and you're kind of totally holding your own, and then you're talking to some guy who's deep into quantum physics, and you're right there in that conversation. It's impressive. But one thing I'm always left with is wanting to know a little bit more about what you really think about some of these controversial topics. So if you'll indulge me, I'm going to kind of ask you, one by one. I mean, take an easy one like ESP. Where do you come down on that? Obviously, you think there's a reality to it. What are the limits to it? What do you think are the key research questions that are unanswered at this point that might be answered in the next 10 years?
Well, the evidence for ESP is overwhelming, and it has been overwhelming for more than a century, as far as I'm concerned. The real exciting frontier for me is the practical applications of ESP in areas like medical diagnosis, archaeology, financial forecasting, and military applications and criminology applications. And more interesting data is accumulating in those areas all of the time. So I'm pretty confident that the day will come. I can't tell you whether it'll be in 50 years or in 500 years, but the day will come when these kinds of applications are going to revolutionize our society completely.
Interesting. Anything else in the psi area? Precognition, psychokinesis, which we're going to talk about when we talk about BK Man, but any of those other things where you see something popping on the horizon?
Well, I do all of them. But when you say something popping, it may take 1,000 years or 5,000 years. I don't know how strong the resistance is, because we're looking at some of the most fundamental barriers that we have as biological creatures for self-protection and for maintaining our individual egoistic sense of identity. And you know, the phenomenon such as extrasensory perception and psychokinesis imply such a vastly different worldview that the forces of resistance, those social forces are very strong, as you know, and are likely to persist for a long, long time. I wish I could say, you know, if it were just the data, if it were just the science, parapsychology would have been widely accepted long, long, long ago. At this point in time, I'm sure many of your listeners realize that since 1969, the American Association for the Advancement of Science has had a formal relationship with the Parapsychology Association. And that's in recognition of the fact that parapsychologists are doing valid science.
Yeah, just don't tell Wikipedia about that. We've got to keep that under wraps. But, okay, so one area where there has been significant progress, and definitely in the last 20 years, especially in the last 10 years, and you talk about this on your show as well, but on survival of consciousness and after-death communication, what do you make of the considerable near-death experience science that's kind of come forward and kind of done an end run on that whole skeptical debate, because they've really reached the general public and the public consciousness in a way that I don't think anyone really saw that coming either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the work in near-death experience is very important. There's an International Association for Near-Death Studies.
But what do you think about that? What do you think about that research?
Well, that's one line of research. There are about a dozen different lines of research, all pointing toward the existence of an afterlife, of survival of consciousness after death. There are probably a dozen different lines of research there.
Sure, but let's get down. So near-death experience research versus the reincarnation research primarily done at UVA with Jim Tucker and formerly Ian Stevenson. You know, compare, contrast. I mean, really, this is what I'm saying. This is the kind of stuff I'd like to hear you say rather than just kind of the party line now that, you know, for the general public. Yeah, there's all these different things. I mean, how do you see, how do you compare those? How do you stack those up? How do you look at those?
Well, the database for both of them is roughly equivalent. We've got thousands of case studies. We have strong evidence, I would say, that something akin to reincarnation actually occurs. I think there's a lot of confusion about it in the popular mind because of psychic readers and past life regression therapists. People often confuse, you know, their wishful thinking and their fantasies with actual reincarnation, but the data is very strong. And then you have to ask yourself, well, if we reincarnate and if we also survive death, those are two windows into what an afterlife might look like. I think that we can form a composite picture of the afterlife by looking at all these lines of evidence as a whole. And that's why I like to talk about them all. I think they all have their weaknesses. And yet, if you look at the overwhelming body of evidence, they're all incredibly strong. And while some skeptics like to dismiss it all as some sort of cognitive errors or wishful thinking, the anyone who takes a close look at the data will realize that the people who are doing research in this area are light years ahead of their critics.
What do you think of the birthmark thing that Jim Tucker, and I think Jim Tucker's really maybe at the tail end of Ian Stevenson's career, where the traumatic death event is correlated with a strange birthmark. Did you ever get into that? What did you find that evidence compelling?
Well, and Ian Stevenson wrote a whole book about it called The Biological Basis of Reincarnation. It's fascinating where if let's say a person dies a violent death, most of the reincarnation cases involve a violent death in the previous life. Somehow that's related to people having retained the memories of the previous life. But often there's a young child who has memories, is born with a birthmark that corresponds to the death wound from the previous lifetime.
Right. So they're off interviewing this kid in Sri Lanka who's never been outside of his village. And he leads him to a village 100 miles away where he says, this is where I'm born. And they interview all the people. And all the people go, yeah, there was this guy. It's exactly as he's describing. And then they go, but he was hit by this, you know, he was stabbed and killed. And lo and behold, the kid has a birthmark in the same spot. Right. I mean, it's just crazy.
Well, it suggests a lot of things from a scientific point of view, that there's some sort of an organizing matrix that carries this information from one lifetime to another. This is very important data. But where it really gets fascinating is in cases where it's not a death wound, but in some cultures, people will actually mark the body of the deceased person, let's say with charcoal. And then a young child will be born with the memories of that deceased person, and they will have a birthmark corresponding to where the body of the previous individual had been marked.
Fascinating. Wow, I didn't know that part of it. That's great. That's really cool.
So, you know, these kinds of phenomena, it's easy for skeptics to dismiss it because they're so bizarre and they defy rationalistic explanations. So I think many people who are in the scientific community would like to believe that we live in a rational world. That's the phrase that they use. And if things don't comport with their idea of how a rational world should operate, well, they simply dismiss it and say it's not worthy of my consideration. They may be making a very big error because there's no a priori reason why the universe should operate according to our idea of how a rational world should behave.
Yeah, awesome. Perfectly said, you know, and that kind of leads me into the next thing, because one of the things I appreciate that you do is you don't set the boundaries, at least you don't set them in the normal place that people do, because the next thing you go into, you're not afraid to explore the UFO phenomenon, the alien contact phenomenon, demonic possession in the occult. I mean, I just don't know how anyone can exclude those or at least put them on the table, but you certainly don't. So what is your best understanding of what's going on when we talk about UFOs and alien contact?
I think a good starting point for a discussion of these things would be F.W.H. Meyer's classic book published in 1902 called Human Personality and Its Survival After Death. And what Myers did is he collected hundreds and hundreds of case studies that had accumulated in the offices of the Society for Psychical Research in London, which was founded in 1882. So he had about 20 years worth of data there. And he put it all together in a spectrum. And what he showed is that you can go to the most extreme cases pointing to survival after death and show that they are part of a spectrum that includes normal human consciousness, that just as we have the electromagnetic spectrum, everything from normal light and radio waves and cosmic rays all on the same spectrum, we have a wide, wide range of phenomena associated with consciousness, including reincarnation, UFOs, demonic possession, and our normal everyday waking consciousness, which is just as much a mystery as everything else.
Great point. Great point. I always like when one of my pet peeves is the hard problem of consciousness. And I always want to say, what's the easy problem of consciousness? That's kind of, but on the UFO thing, I want to drill into that a little bit more, because as you know, in the UFO community, they've suddenly got religion about consciousness, but the way they bring it forward is kind of not always fleshed out completely. So let's nail that down. So if someone comes to you and says, I believe there's a nuts and bolts reality to what I witnessed in the sky, irrespective of whether there's this spectrum of consciousness and it's somehow connected with that and Strassman's DMT beings and all the rest, leave all that aside. Somebody comes and says, hey, there was a nuts and bolts reality to that thing that was flying in the sky. How do you feel about that?
Well, I'm inclined to think that there are dozens of different phenomena that all get lumped together under the rubric of UFOs. And I can't rule out the idea of nuts and bolts machines. But there are some severe problems with that interpretation. For example, some of these craft have been known to they're even tracked on radar sometimes, traveling at thousands of miles an hour and then making a right angle turn instantly. And the normal laws of material science would suggest that that if it were a nuts and bolts aircraft, it would have fallen apart at that time. It couldn't stand the stress of that much a change in physical momentum. So it's very likely that what we're looking at is more a projection from another dimension. The way you can take, for example, a spotlight and project it into the sky so that the beam will appear to move at thousands of miles an hour and make a right angle turn. That can be done. So it suggests that these things are never quite what they seem to be.
But then we have to also mix in there what you said. I mean, we also have the radar, which is approaching a physicalness to it. We also have eyewitness accounts, which don't, but when there are multiple eyewitness accounts spread across, yeah. We have trace elements that a lot of people have explored, and we don't know quite what to make of those. We have people that have said they've come in contact with the physical. So I know you're not dismissing any of that, and you're really painting, I think, very fairly and appropriately kind of this broad kind of thing. And I just want people to get a sense for how you're dealing with all the different data that's out there. And maybe you've done that already, but if there's anything you want to add, you know, please do.
Well, Alex, with regard to the way that I personally process all of this data, it's probably fair to say that my mind works like an encyclopedia. In fact, my first book, The Roots of Consciousness, was called an encyclopedia of consciousness studies. And so I'm willing to kind of take it all in and try and organize it and categorize it, maybe the way a librarian would work with the Dewey Decimal System, that each and every perspective should have its own little niche. I don't think that we're at a point in history now where we are yet ready to have an overarching theory that can explain everything. We're still in the data collection phase.
Great. Well, that's awesome. So one other thing I brought up and I want to swing back to is demonic possession. That just throws a lot of people for a complete loop. The way you approach it, in the spirit that you've shared already in this show, and people get this when they watch New Thinking Aloud, is, hey, that's just another phenomenon that has to be looked at and examined. But, you know, what particularly are your thoughts on demonic possession, malevolent spirits, the spirit world, the hierarchy of consciousness, whatever, you know, what that topology is, as best you understand it at this point? Any thoughts?
Well, you know, the very term demonic, the way you're using it, has sort of theological, religious components. And I think it's useful to remind our viewers that in the history of religions on this planet, what you see are many gods in overthrowing others, many pantheons. The Greek Olympian gods overthrew the Greek Titans. And so the Titans were labeled as demonic. And often when a new religion comes about, the deities of the previous religion are given that demonic label. And then sometimes it's reversed. When Zarathustra developed his philosophy in ancient Persia, he took what had been viewed as a demon or an Asura and made it the head deity of light, Ahura Mazda. So, you know, one culture's demons may be another culture's deities, and not necessarily in a bad sense either.
Well said. You know, one of your recent guests, Richard Smoley, is somebody I quote all the time. I mean, he's, and I haven't seen that interview yet, but one of the things I hope you talked about is his research that when you look at the people of Judea and the Jewish people and their predecessors were really doing with the Old Testament, hey, he goes all the way back and he says, there was just Yahweh and Yahweh was good or bad. And then the next thing you know, they're telling the same story, only they've broken off all the bad parts of Yahweh and they'd have attached him to this guy called Satan. But it's the exact same story. And they probably borrowed it from some Zoroaster kind of dualistic kind of thing. So more evidence of exactly what you're talking about, but now put in a context that, wow, is immediately relevant to, well, the majority of the people on this planet in terms of the Judeo-Christian tradition.
Yeah, we tend to see things from a human perspective and certainly from a cultural perspective, but I think it's also fair to say that if you're willing to take seriously some of these spiritual concepts that we've been talking about, like reincarnation, then issues such as birth and death take on a whole new meaning. And, you know, we often think, well, what could be more evil than death itself? But from a larger perspective, death is not evil at all. It's just part of the process.
Let's talk about evil, though, because one of the fundamental questions for me is the question of the God question, to put it in very simple terms. But I don't like to bypass the fact that the picture that seems to emerge from me is a hierarchical order to consciousness leading towards this goodness. I mean, that does seem to come through, and it comes through in the near-death experience research. It comes in the mediumistic research, a lot of the after-death communication research. Not that there isn't darkness and the rest of that, but that the ascension is towards good. And I think that I'm coming at that from a completely non-religious standpoint. That just seems to be my read of the data. What do you make of that?
Well, it's deeply embedded in our culture. The very word God is related to the word good. And so by definition, the closer you are to God, the closer you are to goodness. On one hand, on the other hand, that creates a duality, good and bad. And many of these great spiritual traditions, such as Advaita, meaning non-duality, say that all dualities are artificial, that good and bad, right and wrong, up and down, east and west, inside and outside, are all part of a whole. They're all part of the oneness of everything itself. Or if you're a Buddhist, you might say the nothingness of everything itself. That you can't have goodness without it's the opposite. They sort of create each other, just as the universe itself, you might say. How do we get a universe out of nothing? Well, you might say mathematically, you can take zero and zero equals minus one plus one.
I get that. I just think, and let me push this a little bit further.
Yeah.
I also step back and I say, okay, philosophically, maybe true. Wisdom traditions, including the great Eastern Buddhist and Hindu traditions, which, you know, all that. Okay. But the data that seems to be coming through, like we said, the 2,000 plus cases of near-death experience that have been analyzed in a scientific way. The mediumistic research seems to be pointing pretty distinctly towards this hierarchy of consciousness, towards this development of the soul thing, a moral imperative towards doing good. I mean, again, I'm saying I'm trying to remove my biases from it and just say that's what the data seems to say.
Well, they're both true. That, you know, it's we often assume a kind of Aristotelian logic where if you can't have duality and non-duality both being true, but that's just a logical premise that we assume. Well, I don't see why at one level what you're saying is perfectly true, that, you know, morality and goodness are an essential part of the spiritual path, and anybody who chooses to ignore them does so at their peril. And yet there is a larger cosmic game going on at the same time, in which good and evil are, it's like watching a movie. You know, one actor plays the villain and one actor plays the hero, but at the end of the day, it's just an interesting story. And both actors are human beings just like us. So it doesn't have to be one or the other. It can be both and.
Great. I'll tell you what, in the time we have left, I promised myself and I guess our listeners at the beginning that I really want to talk about PK Man. I mean, how this isn't, how one, this didn't get you the most distinguished chair at some university or $1 million book deal, I don't know, or started some religious cult, I don't know, but it obviously it didn't. And yet the story is just too amazing to not repeat and retell. So for people who don't know the Ted Owens story and your amazing many year encounter with this, would you mind giving folks a synopsis of what that whole thing was about?
Well, yeah, I met Ted Owens through Hal Puthoff and Russell Targ at SRI International back in 1976 when they were doing their early work in remote viewing and working with Uri Geller and getting funding from the CIA. They were getting a lot of publicity, and Ted Owens learned about it, and he was sending them all of these letters saying things like, "You're wasting your time with Uri Geller because I'm the world's greatest psychic." And to prove it, he said, I'm going to do a demonstration for you. And there was a drought going on in California in 1976, very serious drought. And he said, I'm going to end this drought, and you'll know in a few days because there'll be rain and sleet and hail. There'll be UFO sightings, which are part of my signature of my demonstrations, and power blackouts. And a local newspaper will publish that the drought is over. Well, all of that happened in like 3 days' time. And so Russell Targ sent a little note back to Ted Owens saying, "Congratulations, that was a really good prediction." And Ted Owens wrote back to him and said, "That was no prediction, I caused it." And at that point, Puthoff and Targ realized that this was more than they could deal with, that they were
already, I think it's more than any of us can still deal with. But
well, that's part of the problem. These phenomena are so bizarre, so unbelievable, so threatening to many of our preconceptions about how the world should work, that even very, very open-minded researchers like Puthoff and Targ were eager to get it off of their plate. So when I visited their laboratory, nothing would have pleased them more than, "Jeffrey, please take these files off of our hands."
And we should add to this, because it's a cool part of the story, and it fills in the picture of the kind of social pressures that existed back then. We know they still exist today. But one of the things you point out is the Uri Geller thing was kind of cutting both ways for them. I mean, it was getting everyone excited, but it was also drawing them a lot of heat. And they were like, we don't need more of that.
Yeah. You know, if you're going to get funding from the CIA to do that kind of research, they want you to be very quiet, very respectable, not make a lot of waves. And Uri Geller was already too much of a loose cannon, and Ted Owens would have been far too much for them. So they were very happy that a young, eager graduate student such as myself at the time was willing to take that case off of their hands and look into it. And I met Ted Owens a few months later in London at a conference of the Parascience Foundation at the University of London. They were having a drought, and a little news article about what had happened in California had been published in Psychic Magazine, which was an interesting publication back in that era. And so Professor John Taylor, a mathematician at King's College at the University of London, invited Owens to come to England to end the drought that was going on there. And when I arrived in England, once again, there was a terrible drought. People in some of the towns near London could only get water when it was brought in by truck. And my friends in London told me, if you want your picture on the front page of the London Times, all you have to do is walk down Piccadilly Circus carrying an umbrella. People will take your picture and put it in the newspaper. It will seem so strange. But when Owens arrived, once again, rain and sleet and hail and power blackouts, and the London subway system was shut down. And within a few days, the newspapers announced the drought was over. Just like that. But at the Parascience Conference, when Owens got up to speak, people thought he was a loud American braggart. They wanted nothing to do with him.
Jeff, paint a picture of what this guy looked like and a little bit of his personality, because he didn't care about being off-putting, it sounds like. I mean, it sounds like he kind of relished that in a way. But, I mean, the whole persona, I mean, what does that look like when it comes up on the stage?
Well, he looked like Santa Claus in those days. He was a little heavy set. He had a big white beard and white hair and bushy eyebrows. And he walked onto the stage carrying a toy wagon, like one of those little red wagons that kids have. And it was piled high with papers. And he said, all of these papers are documents from his many demonstrations of his psychokinetic abilities, because he's the world's greatest psychic, and he can end droughts, and he can help end the Cold War, and he can summon UFOs. And
he's an ambassador for the UFOs, right?
He regarded himself as the ambassador to Earth from what he called the space intelligences, invisible beings on an invisible giant spaceship hovering above the planet. Sometimes they took the form, he said, of like giant insects, like praying mantises, and they made high-pitched squeaky noises, and he called them Tweeter and Twitter because of that. And well, he virtually got laughed off the stage. The organizers came in the middle of his presentation and said, oh, excuse us, one of the speakers who had just shown up, and so you have to leave the stage right now. And he was very humiliated and embarrassed by that. And I introduced myself to him at that point, and we struck up a friendship. And later on, I stood up in front of the whole conference and said, I happen to know firsthand about what he had done in California, ending the drought. And, you know, even though he may seem to you to be an unacceptable kind of person, I think we should take him seriously. And he was very grateful that I did that, and we developed a friendship, and I continued to investigate his claims for the next 10 years.
Amazing. So tell us about some of those claims. The story that always sticks in my mind, and I think you have an affidavit from an attorney that saw the lightning thing, is just unbelievable. So maybe tell that story and any other stories.
Instances in the files, and even today, I have two full file drawers with over 160 various demonstrations that he did. And one of the things that he was known for doing is causing lightning to strike. And in one occasion, he was working as a high-speed typist at a law office in Philadelphia, and once again bragging about his abilities. And he said, "I can make lightning strike." And one of the lawyers was with him, and he said, "Okay, they're in this skyscraper looking out the window. It was an overcast day, but there was no lightning in the sky at all." And the lawyer said, "You see that bridge there, the Camden Bridge, leading from Philadelphia into Camden, New Jersey?" He said, "Make lightning strike that bridge." And Owen stood up and he pointed his finger at the bridge. And within about a minute, a bolt of lightning just came out of the sky in the direction of the bridge. It didn't actually hit the bridge, but it was in the vicinity of the bridge. And that lawyer was named Sidney Margulies, and I personally interviewed him, and then maybe about 10 years later interviewed him again, and he remembered those events very, very vividly. It was one of the most impressive things that had ever occurred to him in his lifetime, to see somebody point their finger like that and a bolt of lightning come out of the sky.
Looking back, it's been a couple of years. What do you make when you mull that over in your mind and you think of that whole experience with Ted Owens? What do you make of it? And has your opinion changed over the years?
Well, it's hard to make anything of it because it's so bizarre and there's so many components to it. And Owens himself was such a difficult person. Frankly, when I introduced him to a colleague, Dr. Lee Poulos, who was also a parapsychological investigator, and he described Owens as like a grizzly bear with a burr up its ass.
Right.
But the phenomenon had different components. You could say there was a psychokinesis component. There was a UFO component. There was a precognition component. There were poltergeist activities that constantly seemed to surround him. So all of these things were going on. And I guess one thing it's fair to say, he exemplifies why parapsychologists often use the term psi, the Greek letter psi, to sort of lump all of these phenomena together, because it's sometimes very hard to distinguish one from another, and they all seem to operate in conjunction with each other.
So, Dr. Mishlove, we've talked a lot about New Thinking Aloud, but tell folks what's coming up, what your vision is for the show, where you think you're going to take it, any other projects you might be working on, and the best place to find it, obviously, is on YouTube, right? Or is there other ways to find it?
You can go to New Thinking Aloud, A-L-L-O-W-E-D. It's all one word, newthinkingaloud.com, and that will take you right to the YouTube channel. We've already posted about 200 interviews. I would say at this point I'm specializing in career retrospective interviews with leading researchers in parapsychology. I've turned 70 last year, and many of the people I've known for the last half a century are in their 70s now. They've done marvelous work. I've completed 24 interviews with Stephen Schwartz, who is the great pioneer of psychic archaeology. I've completed a dozen with Charlie Tart, who coined the term altered states of consciousness. I've completed about 10 now with Russell Targ, who helped found the remote viewing research program at SRI International. I've done 14 with Stanley Krippner, who was the pioneer in dream telepathy research and has studied shamanistic traditions all over the world. So I'm hoping to get as many of these senior researchers as possible who are still alive but aren't going to live forever, and get them to reflect back on their life's work. So that's the main thrust of what I'm doing at this point.
It's absolutely fabulous, and it's important work. And I think it will, as your original kind of vision for it, endure.
My pleasure, Alex.
Thanks again to Dr. Jeffrey Mishlov for joining me today on Skeptico. You know, the question I tee up from this interview, because I just can't get past it, is what do you make of the Ted Owens case? What do you make of the PK man? And it seems to me that that's something that either needs to be just broadly debunked. I mean, either the whole thing is just completely contrived and made up, or it completely shatters our understanding of reality. I know that's kind of a big statement, but it's true. Which brings up another point, I guess. I don't know if it's in a question form or not, but it's like, you know, when you talk to Jeff, you kind of get this sense of a guy who's seen it all, done it all to a certain extent, at least in the people he's talked to. And he's very measured and careful about what he says, because he's like saying, dude, if you've been with Ted Owens and you've seen him direct lightning bolts with his finger and summon UFOs, well, then all the rest of this stuff has to fit in a world that's dramatically different than what we imagine it to be on a day-to-day basis. Now, that's my read of it. He never says anything like that, but that's what I'm taking out of this. So how about you? What are your thoughts on that? Let me know. Of course, you can do that through the Skeptico Forum or through the Skeptico website, or send me an email, whatever you like. The website is, of course, skeptiko.com. If you like this interview, I have 350 more of them you can go and listen to. And I hope you do. They're all there, available for free. And I have some more ones coming up. Good ones, I think. It just keeps rolling on. I keep saying I want to do it every other week, and I wind up doing it every week because I love it. But do check it out. Do stay in touch. Take care. Bye for now.